I did what I did for the good of the realm.
The realm?
Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agreed to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie.
But what do we have left once we abandon the lie?
Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all.
Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Many who try to climb it fail, but never get to try again. Fall breaks them. And some, given a chance to climb, they refuse. They cling to the realm. Or the gods. Or love. Illusions. Only the ladder is real. The climb is all there is.
Yes, let chaos be your friend. Terrible Tommy. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in North Central Indiana. 46581 is the zip code. P.O. Box 401. That's right. And it is, guess what? It's November the 3rd, 2015. And it's Tears Day. All day today, Tears Day. I always know it's Tears Day because the trash man comes. Send all your moolah to the P.O. Box 401 for your free trip around the sun with the radio show, White Aryan Resistance radio show. And then go up to the website and wander through the wonderful information we've got up there. You can get a master's degree on resist.com, on race, and on other things too, for that matter. Well, have you gotten down on your knees today and thanked Odin for Cheney and Bush? Huh? I'm being facetious. Well, obviously, these guys are brought chaos. They were the beginnings of hardcore chaos. And they brought down the Middle East. They're in the process of finishing up in the Middle East. Now they're getting ready to bring down Europe. Interesting. It's interesting how this is all going to play out, because this is going to encourage the masses of troglodytes that are south of the border to start making bigger runs on our southwest border. And, of course, the Asians and stuff coming in from Asia across it through Canada. And so forth. Well, we may be on the last legs sooner than I thought. Or we may be on the beginning, like the little speech said in the beginning of the show. One guy looks at the chaos as a pit. They're all going to be drawn into it. Another guy looks at a ladder that we can all try to climb up it. And many can't make it, but I'd rather stick to the ladder than the hell with the pit. So if you don't understand that it's Bush, the Bush-Cheney axis that brought all this crap on, that lit the fuse, then you better start researching again. It all comes out of those two, plus their buddies they work with. So you can thank chaos. Thank those boys for chaos, and boy, they really got it going now. People don't even have any idea what they've left out of Pandora's box, because this is true biological warfare. This is the real stuff, and they're dropping it everywhere. I'm not worried about atomic bombs. It's the biological bombs that are what's important. And, of course, the right-wing racial people in this country, or at least the people who are leading this crap, are doing the same thing they've done 100 times before. rushing to the red light to lose by doing things that they've done 100 times before and they know they don't work. But I'll make it work. Got a daily news clipping here from the High Plains. You've probably seen some of this stuff. Kansas City, Missouri. A neo-Nazi who made headlines when he bought land in small North Dakota town with plans to turn it into an all-white hamlet is now setting his sights on Kansas and Nebraska. If I've ever seen a false flag, I see him now. I've been talking for years about working class whites moving out to small towns and starting businesses and keeping their mouths shut, dig in, become part of the community, so forth. Well, someone wants to make sure that doesn't happen. I don't think it's an accident. You got to muddy the waters all over the place so that nothing works. Nothing. Anyhow, we've got Craig Cobb, who initially I thought he was a pretty sharp guy. And he probably is. The question who he serves and who VNN serves that puts these kind of people out front with the likes of Glenn Miller and people like that. Craig Cobb has purchased property in two south central Nebraska towns and inquired about property in north central Kansas towns, including Smith Center. Well, who are you going to put in those towns? The same kind of people you had up there at Leith? The same old right-wing crap? Now, he gets the cart before the horse. You got to find the right kind of people, honorable white people, reasonably moral white people, and encourage them to move into these areas. Not the dregs of society. Cobb said in an interview that he plans to sell the property at deep discounts to young white couples. You see, Cobb's getting his money from his family. It'd be a little bit more interesting if he had earned this money himself. But he gets handouts from his mother, I guess. One of discounts to young white couples is part of the effort called Pioneer Little Europe that would create planned communities for white nationalists. The strategy is a national movement. Well, you don't have to yell to the sky. You just quietly move in and do it. But you see, the trouble is when the right wing calls for people to come on in, they always get scum. Or they get the Hollywood National Socialists coming to town. Or the modern version of the KKK, Hollywood KKK. They immediately turn off everybody in the goddamn 100-mile area. Well, when that happens quite a bit, you begin to wonder what was the real motive behind the thing in the first place. I encouraged him at first because I thought he was going to use his brain and quietly bring people in that'd be checked out and could build something in these small towns without having a Nazi rally every weekend or flying flags all over the damn place. Okay. Cobb's action already have stirred fear in some of the Kansas and Nebraska communities. Yeah, because there's always the people out there that hate our guts and hate your guts and mine that are waiting on this kind of stuff. And this is the way they not only make money, but build what stupid progressive or whatever politics they want to push. And all the politicians will jump on it too. Oh, we got to go fight these guys. Once Cobb's identity was discovered in the small towns, word circulated quickly and residents warned owners to be wary of selling property to him. in Red Cloud, Nebraska, dozens gathered at the town hall meeting. What are we going to do? Run for your life. The Nazis are coming. There was a good showing of people, good attendance, Mayor Gary Raslaff told the Kansas City Star. Let's just say everyone is concerned. We had better be concerned about your goddamn crooked congressmen and senators that are ripping your states off of all their minerals and oil and all that kind of crap. Befouling your water and stealing your water. Do you know that the Saudi Arabians are stealing massive amounts of water out of Arizona and out of the Imperial Valley in California, doing it by harvesting vast amounts of hay that carries a hell of a lot of water. Nobody talks about that, but here's a Hollywood Nazis coming to town. Run for your life. Cobb said other white nationalists, of which I hate that term, white nationalist. I'm a white racist. A white racist separatist. They've been buying up property as well. We have property and people in place in the area, he said. I'd rather not speak to precisely what we have and what we bought, except to tell you it's a lot more extensive than just this. Cobb purchased the Nebraska property at Webster County Sheriff's sale on September 23rd. He bought a house in Innavale for $3,410 and two properties in Red Cloud for $25 and $100. Cobb, who was raised in St. Joseph, Missouri, first created a stir when he started buying plots in the tiny town of Leith. And the article goes on. Well, boys, we've either got false flags by the enemy or false flags by idiots that are supposed to be not our enemy. I sort of laid off Cobb for a while, you know. I even sent him some law books in the jail and tried to help him out. Gave him a couple of bulletproof vests, which I never got back. So anyhow, the right wing is a total, absolute, I'm talking about the white racial right, is a total, absolute failure. In fact, they're worse than a failure. They're an albatross around our neck. You've got to turn to a different direction. Lone wolf, leaderless resistance, environment, anti-war. Those are the kinds of things you need to get into. Anyhow, I've got, let's see here. I've got another book here, and I was going to read on about our southern adventure, but I think we ought to read a little bit out of the Camp of the Saints today, because that's a timely situation. Jean Rez Pale wrote this. I believe he was French. He wrote this book. Wait a minute. When did he do this? Okay. I don't see the date of publication. It's been at least 20 years ago. In the front it says, "And when the 1,000 years are ended, Satan will be released from his prison and will go forth deceiving the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, and will gather them together for the battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea. And they went up over the breadth of the earth and encompassed the camp of the saints and the beloved city." The next quote was from Lawrence Durrell. "My spirit turns more and more towards the West, toward the old heritage. There are perhaps some treasures to retrieve from among the ruins. I don't know." This is from Solzhenitsyn. "As seen from the outside, the massive upheaval in the Western society is approaching the limit beyond which it will become metastable and must collapse. Now, facing the balloons on housing and all kinds of economic situations, plus the invasion of Europe, which I believe was well thought out, and it wasn't an accident. Merkel is the Rosa Luxemburg of the day, or maybe even worse. And I wouldn't put it past that Putin, she's a secret agent for Putin, to calm Europe down and break up the EU. It would definitely benefit Putin's Russia. So I don't know. I call her a Manchurian candidate. Whether she's just insane and did this stuff, without her, it wouldn't have taken off so fast. But someone said her mother was Jewish. Well, like my wife used to say, you don't have to be a Jew to be a bastard, but it helps. I mean, I get up in the morning and try to turn on the news, and I'm almost afraid to turn on the news the way it's going today. My only question is, who's going to be the new Hitler in Europe? Because you know there's going to be one or two or three. Yeah, of course. Once things go to shit like this, there's only one thing that works: dictators. Dictators can be good, and dictators can be bad. It'd be interesting to see, once these dictators started emerging on the scene, which way they'll go. Now, they'll probably use the strength of the right to go that way, but that's a very dangerous path, as we found out with the end results of Uncle Adolf in Europe. So it's going to be interesting to see. Hopefully, a dictatorship in Europe would swing to the good things on the left and attach to the racial situation. But the EU is going to collapse. It can't possibly survive all this. And if Merkel doesn't get out of there pretty soon, she'll probably be taken out right in Berlin. She better get on a plane and head for wherever the people are that put her up to this, if she wants to save her kike ass. I'm going to read the back cover of this book. It'll give you an idea if you've never read it. Allegory or Prophecy? Is Raspail's apocalyptic vision really the way the white world will end? Already a sensation in Europe, this brilliant controversial novel is about the haves and the have-nots of the world. Well, I'd say the whites and the non-whites. The mighty white nations, confronted by legions of impoverished, starving, black and yellow people known as the Third World. The time is near future. In New York City, racial violence has become a way of life, and barricades have been erected around the black ghettos. In London, 800,000 Commonwealth nationals are demanding their full human rights. In Manila, a French cruise ship has been invaded and seized. Millions of Chinese are massed along the Russian border and across the world. Refugees' fleets are forming. The attention of the Western world is focused on India, where a million men, women, and children have boarded 100 dilapidated freighter ships. It is the Last Chance Armada, a pathetic convoy bound for paradise, a nonviolent crowd of survivors coming in the flesh to knock at long last at the gates of Europe. As new bulletins flash around the world, everything seems to indicate that the final destination will be France. What will be done? What are these people? Pitiful refugees or a pitiful enemy? Saint-like sufferers or an invading army? Awesome in the dramatic descriptions, written with passion and ironic eloquence. This compelling novel will infuriate some readers, yet no one will forget it or remain unaffected by the questions it raises about the future of the world. Now, the author, Jean Raspail, was born in 1925, and since 1949 he's traveled across the world: Peru, Japan, Congo, Israel, Hong Kong, Macau. Out of the experience has emerged his most characteristic writing, a classic and controversial account of the West Indies Sequins Le Cocatier, two novels, La Vente des Pins, translated into 9 languages, and Les Vues de Santiago, and a collection of stories, Le Tom Tom de Jonathan. In 1970, the Academy of France awarded him its Jean Walther Prize for the whole of his work. So anyhow, that's a little bit about the author. Now, this guy was so far ahead, you know, because it's probably around 1980, probably back in there when I was running for office, that I first read this book. And I was really impressed by it. And I could see it coming. But it sort of was slow coming. Or maybe, according to nature, it came fast. But now it's an avalanche. It's moving so fast that no amount of democratic talking or meetings or anything like that will work. It's got to take ruthless reaction. But there's got to be ruthless reaction, of course, against the people who caused it. The Pentagon, military-industrial complex, United States military, Wall Street, Federal Reserve, the IMF, all those people that served up the Mideast on a platter to be crucified. So before you necessarily pin all the blame and on the people running away trying to get out of the Middle East, first pin it on the people who caused it. The Bush-Cheney bunch and all these other people I mentioned, they're the ones that need to be hunted down and hanged, and then to sweep out Europe, just like you'd sweep a dirty floor. But it has to be a ruthless sweeping out. It can't be genteel. And anyone who resists will have to be done away with. It's too bad. It's not what I would have liked to seen in the... I didn't like the way the Mideast thing was going, that's for sure. And I surely don't like the way this is going, but the only true response will be a ruthless sweeping of the floor. I'm going to start on the 38th chapter here, with just a few days before these masses of non-whites get off these ships and invade France and Europe. My friends and fellow countrymen, the voice was calm and self-assured, solemn but forceful. One could sense these were no offhand remarks, that the president had labored long and hard, searching his soul, that he himself had weighed every word before writing it down. Many of the older people listened and thought back to the grim, distant past, to the years between 39 and 45, when heads of state speaking to their people really had something to say, and the people something to ponder. The younger ones had never heard anything like it, and many were suddenly struck by their hollow existence, the void they had taken for meaningful life, decked out in trappings of historical dialectic. To their great regret, but too late to matter, but maybe it won't have been in vain, if God, the resurrector and the dispenser of eternal life, restores the whites to their proper place when they rise from the dead at the crack of doom. 5 hours from now, as the day dawns on this Easter Monday morning, we shall either have lost or preserved our integrity as a nation so jealously guarded for 1,000 years and more. At this juncture in time, a fearful and fearsome honor is ours, that of serving as a test, an example, a symbol. For other Western nations, too, are faced at this moment with a similar threat, and they, too, like ourselves, are unwilling to confront it. 5 hours from now, 1 million refugees will peacefully begin to set foot on our soil. Refugees whose race, religion, and language and culture are different from our own. For the most part, they will be women and children and jobless, the needy, the peasants, all fleeing from famine and misery and despite and despair. Dramatic examples of that ever-growing store of surplus humanity, victims of a soaring birth rate that has long been the curse of our century's waning years. Their fate indeed is tragic, but our own in turn is no less so. If human nature were not as it is, if it truly could have been changed by the active new ideas to which we paid lip service in recent years, then perhaps, in fact, we might have been able to welcome the Third World here to our shores, to open our arms and hearts to these first of their number, and precede them together to build ourselves a new society better gifted to face tomorrow's teeming world. As it is, we can't help but admit that our national reaction at the crucial moment has been one of repugnance, that kind of terror that the past has always seen produced by the confrontation between the races. Except for few social dissidents and idealists, fanatics or misfits, for the most part, our people have fled from the south of France in droves. One of our nation's most prosperous regions has turned into a wasteland, simply because those who live there prefer to leave it all behind rather than share their lives in an effort at coexistence. The reaction is hardly new. History offers us many examples, though our conscience, perhaps to its credit, has chosen not to remember them all, but therein lies the difference. I have no choice as your president elected by the nation. I cannot fail to act. I know, of course, that most of our people consider it inhumane and unthinkable to throw armed might against a weary, starving, and defenseless opponent. Yes, I know how they feel, and yet, my friends, the fact of this cowardice towards the weak is cowardice at the most subtle and indeed the most deadly. And so they all hope that the army, with no such scruples, would come to the rescue, though clearly they had little faith. I'm afraid since they all turned and ran at the first signs of flight, my duty demanded that I order the army to take up positions along the coast. The result is that now, should we only choose to do so, we are perfectly able to repulse the invasion and destroy the invader, assuming that is that we are willing to murder with or without regret 1 million hapless wretches past wars have abandoned in just such crimes, but conscience back then hadn't yet learned to waver. Survival was all, and it was condoned the carnage. Besides, those were wars of rich against the rich. Today it's the poor who are on attack with their ultimate weapon, and if we respond with the same kind of crime, not a soul will condone our action. Our integrity as a nation will have been preserved, but we will surely bear the mark of our deed forever. Certain forces abroad in the world today know this only too well. Those dark forces bent on destroying our Western society, ready to plunge forward into the wake of the invader. Behind the convenient shield that our guilty conscience provides them. My friends and fellow countrymen, I have therefore ordered the army to open fire if need be to prevent the refugees from effecting a landing. But if I have decided after sober consideration to deny the Armada its one last chance, I do so only to save yours. And so I'm asking every soldier. The voice stopped short. For at least 30 seconds, the sentence hung suspended on the airwaves, and nothing was heard through that eternity of silence but the president's labored breathing. When he finally continued, it seemed he could hardly speak. His voice was so much weaker and slower, so unsure of itself, so choked with emotion. It was clear that he had put his prepared speech aside. Sometime later, in fact, historians found the typewritten text in his studio archive. Comparing it with his actual remarks, they all agreed that just at the final moment, his will had apparently cracked, like a cliff long eaten away from beneath, and then suddenly crumbling. Shocked by what he had written, tormented by the thought of the awesome results of his words might engender. The president had changed his mind after 30 seconds of final reflection and had let his heart and his conscience speak out. And for 30 seconds, the world, too, heard only its own anxious breathing. Then each word, heavy and meaning, and handfuls of earth thrown into the grave and into the coffin, words of farewell. Quote, "And so I'm asking every soldier and officer, every member of our police, asking them from the depths of my conscience and my soul to weigh this monstrous mission for themselves and to feel free to either accept it or reject it. To kill is hard, even harder to know why. Myself, I think I know, but I don't have my finger on the trigger, and my gun isn't aimed point blank at some poor soul's flesh. My friends, whatever happens, may God help us or forgive us." On that Easter Monday morning, the sun rose at 5:27. Between the last word of the President of the Republic, 10 after midnight, and the first rosy glimmer of dawn on the water, 5 hours and 17 minutes exactly, hung over the West. No French national anthem had followed the address. Contrary to custom. A custom continued throughout the years for some bizarre reason, despite the droll anachronism of its stirring lyrics mouthed by the flabby new breed of Infants de la Patrie. Instead, in Rougette de Lisle's rightful place, more Mozart, just like that, all of which prompted Colonel Dragas to conclude that France, in her panic, was showing a little tact at last, and that maybe, for all her faintness of heart, would loathe herself less. When man finally conquers his false self-image, be it only a dim and time-worn reflection of an all-but-vanished shadow left lingering faintly in the back of his mind, there's nothing much to do but to play him his taps. There were two men that night who came to the same conclusion. First, Monsieur Jean Aurel in Paris, with a telephone call to the station to air the Mozart Requiem again. It was clear from President's dramatic finale that his will was no longer his own. Well, if all was lost, why not face the facts squarely? During his long career, the minister had lived through too many disavowals. He had witnessed too many defeats, all touted as triumphs to the gullible public, or as noble self-sacrifice, or national redemption. He had heard them all followed by pompous hymns, whose flood of words and succeeded in washing away their shame. May as well die a dignified death when you've lived too long, turned so many pages, intelligently, of course, but without the slightest notion that these were the last in a drawn-out tale. The suddenly stumble across the words, the end, words you thought were way off in the distance, hallowed in justice, perfection, and universal love, words ablaze, in fact, with nothing but hate, and looming up so quickly that they deal you a death blow straight to the heart. Could humanity have lost its way somewhere inside the maze? Did you shut too many doors? Doors you should have kept open? Whatever the cost, instead of digging pitfalls and traps to catch the blind. How many escapes did you help to block off? myself, Gene Drill, Gene O'Rail, the whole world read me, listened to what I said, discussed me devoutly, turned me into a sage, heaped me with honors, bowed and scraped and drank my words and lived by my deeds, transformed my life into a royal road, straight as an apostle's conscience and fair as a prophet's holy vision, while truth, with her bruised and bleeding feet, wandered lost and rejected among the thorns and brambles of a tortuous path. How many gates did I help to fling open, gates to delusion? Ah, I should have been more careful. I knew, after all, I knew the truth always goes her way alone. If the masses join in, if they fall in step behind her, it's a sign that she must have sold herself out. But I let myself be fooled, Monsieur Jean Aurel. Requiem? Yes, let everyone hear it. Maybe some will understand. The minister carefully examined the revolver, the 1937 Soviet model. His hand fell once more into the long-forgotten gestures. Defense of Madrid, Spain, liberation of Paris, capture of Chongqing, China, attack on Salisbury, Rhodesia, ghetto revolt in Atlanta, USA. This time the old revolver didn't jam. They found the minister sitting slumped at his desk, his head in a pool of blood as his mouth had spat it out and were trying to suck it back in. Just before dying, he had scratched out this curious phrase, quote, impure or pure. Since he always had revealed in obscure pronouncements, and even more so late in his life when he took almost senile delight in excessive obtuseness, people groped far afield in their search for the meaning. His many biographers racked their brains on the posthumous puzzle. One hit it quite close when he saw in the phrase a reference to blood, and more abstractly to Aurel's pure or impure motives at the moment of death. Strangely enough, to the best of our knowledge, no one grasped the connection with the sang impure of our old national anthem. That vile enemy blood to be spilled in the cause of freedom. Of course, the national anthem was changed not long after, and about time, too. As for Colonel Dragus, he had little taste for Mozart. He was all right in principle, but there had to be some more military way of confronting oblivion, and so he hounded his staff. Quote, get me some bugles, drums, damn it. If there are any left, a call went out the length of the front, as a result of which, by the way, it was learned that in the 5 minutes following the president's address, five more units had slipped off into the night or joined the ranks of the Panama Ranger. The Marine Commandos saved the day, four strapping specimens in camouflage suits, crosses dangling from their hairy chest, went crawling on their bellies over the beaches and rocks, yelling shit at each verbal offense from Panama's Ranger pacifist crew, invisible in the darkness, but in the front was alive with them. You could feel them in the air like insects burrowing under the skin or some gangrenous rot, and with drum and bugle, as this case might be slung over their shoulders, and they made their way to the headquarters in Villa. Quote, you know how to play taps? Unquote, the colonel snarled. Quote, commando specialty, colonel. That's what we used to go over the top. Works even better than the cavalry charge. Chad, Guinea, Djibouti, Madagascar, Pan-Paparan. Very impressive. Objectives. Objective? Slaughter. By the way, the captain sends his regards. Fine, give me a round of taps and try not to flub any notes. They stood by the five tanks of the 2nd Hussars, Chamberant Regiment, lined up in a garden outside the villa, under the pines, two drummers, two buglers. Not much of a band, but there in the darkness they were loud as an army. Picture the scene moments after midnight, taps blared out by the light of the moon. pure theater. Quote, "Oh, that tugs at the heart," unquote, moaned Undersecretary Perot, half in jest. The colonel was smiling too, a big broad grin, jubilation all around. The ones who truly love their tradition don't take them too seriously. They march to get their heads shot off with a joke on their lips. And the reason is that they know they're going to die for something intangible, something sprung from their fancy, half humor, half humbug. Or perhaps it's a little more subtle. Perhaps hidden away in their fancy is that pride of the blue blood who refuses to look foolish by fighting for an idea, and so he cloaks it with the bugle calls and the tug at the heart. With empty mottos and useless gold trim, and allows himself to be the supreme delight of giving his life for an utter masquerade. That's something the left has never understood, and that's why his contempt is so heavy with hate. When it spits on the flag or tries to piss out the eternal flame, when it hoots at the old farts loping by their berets or yell women's lib outside the church, at an old-fashioned wedding, to cite just some basic examples, it does so in such a grim, serious manner, like such pompous assholes, as the left would put it. If only it could judge, the true right is never so grim. That's why the left hates its guts, the way a hangman must hate the victim who laughs and jokes on his way to the gallows. The left is a conflagration. It devours and consumes in deadly dull earnest. Even its rebels' appearances notwithstanding are as grisly an affair as one of those puppet parades out of Peking or Nuremberg. The right is different. In a flickering flame, a will-o'-the-wisp in the petrified forest fitting through the darkness. "That's fine," said the colonel. "Good job. Now get back to your unit and tell the captain thanks. Oh, yes. On the way, you can check out the barbed wire and call in a report." No sooner had he finished his sentence than the Panama Ranger sent back his reply to the bugles and drums, a studied cacophony, a jumble of everything more or less in the Ballad of Man's Last Chance, on guitar voices spitting slogans or singing songs, like the khaki bye-bye or the ninny hooker or the case of the motorized crabs, and all to a background of sputtering motors or hoots and horns, of squeals of delight from girls being felt up and asking for more, even neo-literal hymn, some old spiritual change for the occasion. It varied according to where the sounds came from. Each one of the houses shared the racket. Now, you got to understand, the people that are going to oppose the entry of this rabble into France and Europe are outnumbered, because the left in France, like most of the left, is actually welcoming these people in, no matter how rotten or how messed up it is. And that's the way it is here. And that's the way it is in Europe. You see all these people opening up they don't open up their own doors. They open up everybody else's doors to this massive amounts of Untermenschen coming in. They can't wait. And they want to fight the right wing in the streets in favor of letting this rabble come into their, taking over their country. Right. So, you know, in a situation like this, if it takes place in this country, there's going to have to be a massive civil war of whites that understand and whites that don't understand, and they're going to be killed. Otherwise, the rest cannot be taken care of. "Pretty, huh?" mumbled the colonel. "It reminds me of all those New Year's Eves when we were stationed at Tarbes. It used to drive my men up the wall, me too, on boring nights like that. But I tried not to show how much it pissed me off to see the people having their fun. Just press a button and boom, you see what you get. what they were getting just then, in fact, struck the colonel's staff in the villa with its volume. The night wasn't even half over, and already the troop strength had shifted. How many did Panama Ranger have now? See, the Panama Rangers was the ones that want to fight to let these people in. 20,000? 25? And the army? They took another count, unit by unit, no more than 6,000 at the very outside. Not to mention, of course, a group of number three, the Third World contingent, almost 1 million refugees, biding their time waiting for daylight on their grounded ships and caught in the rhythmic sweep of the giant searchlight mounted on the roof of the villa. Like the culture, the biologist checks his microscope now and then to make sure his microbes are still alive and kicking. We can forget 55 million Frenchmen stunned by the noxious gases of modern thought, paralyzed where they stood in grotesque positions as if some director had frozen the background action on the stage to emphasize only the essentials. The one common quality of all three forces possessed was a communicative scorn. Could that be one explanation? Quote, "We're losing 1,000 men every hour," said the commander de Pontus, "and no one's even fired a shot." "So what?" replied the colonel. "I see things from a different angle. The way I figure it is a hemorrhage that keeps up like this. By 2027, by 5:27 this morning, I'll still have 450 men, more than I expected." With the undersecretary's permission, he was looking at Jean Perret. Both men seemed to enjoy still playing the roles of soldier statesmen. "I'm going to get rid of all those fancy toys you had them send me. I mean, all those rubber bullets, fire hoses, tear gas grenades, lead-weighted nets, and all those other fun games we'd use on a mob of the Latin Quarter kids. We'll load up with live ammunition, that's all." "You too," Perret countered, "and you won't even have our 450. You'll have 50, if you're lucky, unless they decide to call it a day and shoot you in the back." "Well, then I'll die like an old-time sergeant stuck away in an all-African battalion. That's not a bad death. A bullet in the back and no one will know who did it. What the hell's the difference? When you're dead, you're dead. Well, are we ready? They've shot their mouths off long enough. What say we shut them up?" "Good idea, Colonel." Commander de Pontus agreed. "My ears can't take it. Let me volunteer." But Colonel Perret interrupted. "The real enemy is in front of you, out on these boats. It's not that gang of loudmouthed left-wingers behind you." "Oh, you think so, Monsieur?" the colonel objected. "I can see you've never done much fighting. In war, the real enemy is always behind the lines." "Boy, I agree with that. Never in front of you, never among you, always at your back. That's something every soldier knows, in every army since the world began, and plenty of times they've been tempted to turn their backs on the enemy, so the so-called enemy, that is, and give it to the real one, once and for all. In the good old days, you could even see two armies at each other's throats in some stupid war or other, and all of a sudden, they'd call it quits, and each one would pull a coup and take over at home. I'm sorry I wasn't around to see it." "No, my friend, in war the soldier's real enemy is seldom who you think. And when there are no more soldiers, then there's no more war. At least, not worthy of the name, which is just what's going to happen this morning, by the way. When my last hussar runs out on me, you'll see. The country will be at peace. What kind of peace? I really can't say. I don't want to live through it. That much I know. Let the rest of them wallow in their peace. It's what they've been yelling for these years, without the slightest idea of what it was. If you ask me, they'll get what's coming to them, That's all. Are you still volunteering, Captain? It's like reading out of today's newspaper. Yes, Commander de POTUS answered. You want me to shut them up? Nothing would please me more, replied the colonel. They're not quite what I had in mind in the future of the nation. Take my tanks and get going. The whole of our armor in the hands of sailor. Kind of funny, don't you think? Yes, of course. They both thought it was funny. The captain was laughing out loud. The colonel's eyes were alive with delight. They had understood each other. Every military man's love loves war. The ones who claim they don't are liars. Either that or they should be chucked the hell out, sacked without pay, because they're really only civilians in disguise, like post office clerks. Both men had felt that the Ganges fleet was hardly the perfect enemy for their final fling at war. Now they found themselves another, one that truly measured up, proper motive and all, and one that could even fight back. What more could you ask for? And the fight back they did, since every young idiot's dream is to make like the Warsaw rebels. As long as there's no real risk that the grown-ups will mix in with the more than a slap, five tanks groping along the dark with no infantry support are a windfall for 10,000 drunk and drugged heroes sitting around all night making Molotov cocktails, first swilling the rot gut and wine to be sure, in a wild hue and cry that made up the madcap free-for-alls of the old Paris commune clubs seemed like pretty small potatoes. The girls, in particular, vastly gifted in the ways of popular culture, took into their heads a turn cat each occupied town into a people's living theater, one big live sex show, left and right, but only for the best of patriotic reasons. Their brand, patriotic in reverse, for making one Molotov cocktail a blowjob, for two, a first-rate lay, no holds barred, for digging one tank trap, a gangbang for all the diggers and the niggers. Since it had gone on like that for 3 days, bedding down each night in a different place after each of their highway encounters, the troops of the Panama Ranger had a hefty share of those clapped-up pissers, that no revolutionary army worth its salt could possibly exist without. Now, if we think for a moment of the refugee fleet, and the picture its even heftier share, complete with its assortment of pus, scab, chenier, chancre, condemned for the last 2 months to a monumental daisy chain of sodomy and sex, then we have to admit that the Union, if these two fate races, not to mention others, is bound to produce a result well worth watching. At long last, that famous and fundamental doubt, would you let your daughter marry a nigger, will burst like the rabble, like a bubble. Outside that, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. After centuries of struggle with bacterial odds, the white race finally had cleansed its genes of the old-fashioned pox and its nasty results, zealously passed down over the years, but weaker and weaker with every generation. Now we'll have to start from scratch, that's all, though of course we'll have plenty of time. But let's get back to the front and our heroes, and let's give credit where credit's due. The Panama Ranger was anything but chicken. When four or five tanks submerged in a deluge of human flesh, like Gulliver and Lilliput, blew up in a joint attack of hundreds of Molotov cocktails, he stood up alone on the red glowing darkness and barked, "Leave the last one for me." Behind him, his house was a pile of rubble, buried inside a few of his braves, caught napping where they lay. Commander de POTUS had launched the offensive, and the Panama Ranger was playing the scene like a Western. Lit up by a fire, a bottle in each hand, he stalked forward step by step against his foe. Now remember, these are not the people coming in on the ships. These are Frenchmen fighting Frenchmen who are trying to stop them. That's what the Panama Rangers were. You think that wouldn't happen? Of course, it happens all the time. The wild steel beast stopped dead in its tracks, as if cowed by his look. It's still far from clear what prompted the captain to open the turret and poke his head and shoulders up out of his shell, most likely to know who it was he was fighting, or rather to see, to take a good look, that physical need any real soldier feels trapped in the push-button army and faced once again with the timeless truth of man-to-man combat. What he saw there amazed him. A tall, slender young man in the middle of the road, standing calm and determined, feet spread apart, a smile on his face, eyes fixed in blue unblinking gaze, alone by choice, yet the picture of power and strength, mainly grace combined. "Are you having fun?" Commander DePotis shouted. "A ball," came back the reply. And it struck them both that they were laughing together. "I'm going to count to three," the captain warned. "Me too," was the answer, which set the Navy man musing on how much life he had changed. Time was, he thought, man used to use 20-year-olds like the conquering angel to build them his empires and amaze the world. Today we only use them to destroy ourselves included, and for nobody else's amazement but our own. Then he thought of his son, Mare DePotis, killed off the coast of Mauritania, with no smile on his lips, no chance to do battle. In the light of 1,000 years soon ending, hadn't the poor boys chosen the wrong side somehow? "Three," shouted Panama Ranger, as he flung two cocktails with deadly precision. One set the captain on fire like a torch, the other exploded at the rim of the turret, and sent its flame shooting down inside the tank, blowing it sky high. No time at all. Panama Ranger gave a flick of his hand like a friendly wave goodbye. If we've gone into rather a lot of detail over this unique encounter, it's because in the dismal mass of first-hand documents for historians to ponder, this one alone leaves the different impression. Yes, there's loss of life, to be sure, but still it stands out like a flourish of trumpets, sharp, clean, finally, in the welter of actors and spectators caught in the whole tragic drama. Now there is someone to be proud of. One man is dead, one man is still living, but that's not the point. The two are worth all the rest put together. Break up the pair, and the twin that's left serves no purpose. Their clash at long last sparked the first heroic glimmer in the whole mucked-up mess. The historian turns the page and reads on. He'll feel a little more than a twinge of nostalgia, but only the vaguest, since such time-worn feelings are really beyond his ken. At any rate, this encounter was the last one that night, and indeed the last one of that whole crumbling front. "Well, it looks like I have no more armor," the colonel noted simply as he heard the fifth explosion. "I must say, you don't seem awfully concerned," Jean Perrette observed. "And why should I? They died a beautiful death. What more do you want? Death like that is a blessing. Why else do you think I sent them out there? But a few hours from now, when the invasion begins, even 5 tanks could have helped you stop it. Come now, you think that my men are going to shoot at that pack of miserable niggers? I'm not even sure I can do it myself. I just don't understand you, Dragus. Why all the fuss, then? Why the mad rush over the road to get here? Why all the trouble to stir up the army, or what little was left? Why even accept the assignment in the first place? You'll understand soon enough, Monsieur Perrette, as long as I can manage to work things out in my own satisfaction, and I think I can, to your satisfaction. Quite mine, and yours too. I imagine a few others like this. That's the main thing, isn't it? All the rest, He gave a casual toss of the hand. The important thing really is not to botch our exit, especially since it's for keeps. I'm sure it's going to work out fine. It was just then that the radio crew in the villa received a message from the Marine commandos. Barbed wire cut all over. Colonel infiltration possible up and down the front. Well, what are you waiting for? Get out there and fix it. The reply was concise. They had barely enough men on hand to keep their patrols and maintain communications, but certainly not to go stringing barbed wire, that was for sure. Fine, fine, said the colonel, and he gave the impression that he actually meant it. A few more minutes and it would be 3 a.m. And that's the end of our reading for today. So the army has fallen apart, and the good ones were murdered by the rabble, the people who open the gates and who want these people in and who are too stupid about the ramifications. So now they've cut the wires along a beach, and these masses of 1 million troglodytes will begin the invasion tomorrow. And I'll pick it up tomorrow and see how you like it, okay? You won't like it. You won't like it.
I'm going to make them an offer, Captain.
Save your hate for the State Department, for the Pentagon, for Washington, and Wall Street. And if you've got any more left, I'll let you figure it out.